a course of action that set folks' feet in right ways. Someone that had robbed him of Ulf's buckle. Very well, without material evidence, one must produce some other kind of proof. What had Brother Tige said? That it was unusual for such a crime to have no witnesses at all? Somerled could not have killed his brother thus, with such elaborate attention to detail, without at least one accomplice. Find that man, persuade him to talk, and there would be a case. Present that man before the men of the court, Olaf Sveinsson, Harald Silvertongue, the more reasonable of Ulf's advisers, and he could sway the balance here. The men of Rogaland were not blind to what was right. A warrior might charge into the attack without weighing the character of his enemy, but he would never pledge allegiance to a brother-killer. Prove his guilt, and Somerled would be finished. He'd need help. It would have to be Eirik. Eirik, who now dwelt in the south, where it was just possible witnesses might be found and coerced to speak out against their chieftain. Big, wild-bearded Eirik was quite good at getting people to talk, with limited damage. A course of action began to emerge. Get out of this hole, find his brother, hide while a witness was sought, return to Somerled's court and present the case. If only Somerled conducted matters as Magnus did back at Freesfjord. The formal proceedings of a thing would provide the measure of protection needed to put a case together, as well as a forum where all arguments must get a fair hearing. That was all he asked. But it seemed Somerled had dispensed with the thing, making himself sole arbiter and judge. He alone would determine punishment. That surely was too much power, even for the wisest of men. Odin's bones, he hoped Eirik would not look at him with the shock and scorn he had seen in the eyes of Erland and Holgar. Escape. He knew how he would do that. It was just a matter of resting, of eating this foul lump of moulded bread and drinking this brackish water, and being ready at dawn when they opened the door, tomorrow or the next day, as soon as he was strong enough. Rest now, slow the wild thoughts, calm the thundering heart, make the limbs easy. Sleep safe, my bright star. Dream of fair things, my hand in yours. 2 days later, when Somerled's men came up to the isolated building to relieve the guards on duty, they found one fellow sprawled in the entry to the bolted cell, quite unconscious, with a red lump the size of a goose egg on his head, and a bowl of cold porridge splattered all about on the ground. If the man had borne any weapons, they were gone now. The other guard was face down over the stone dike that ran from hut to farmhouse. His skull bore a nasty gash, as if struck with some force by an iron rod or bar. Now that they looked closer, it seemed the very bolt that served to keep the prisoner in had been wrenched from its pins and used to render this fellow insensible, for the great length of rusted metal lay there in the field beyond. A flock of ewes with early lambs at foot grazed peacefully around it. When they saw that, the men muttered and threw glances at one another. Perhaps it was true what folk said, that this was no ordinary warrior, but a vengeful ghost come back from beyond the grave. Did not such a feat demonstrate a strength beyond the purely mortal? As for Warfetter, Somerled must have been wrong. This was no shrinking invalid, but a warrior best avoided unless you had a troop of heavily armed men at your back. And even then, you couldn't be sure he wouldn't fell you with a neat little tap of the fist. And what about the dog? The dog might be back at any time, creeping up with its bloody fangs ready to rip you to shreds. The man was best left alone, if you ask them. Trying to get hold of a fellow like that was a bit like trying to bring a dragon or hill troll to heel, both exceedingly daring and very, very stupid. But when they took the news to Somerled, he sent them straight back out again, and two of his wolfskins with them. They must spare no effort, leave no possibility unexplored. Eivind had been his friend. Eivind was to be found and brought back alive. What the man had done could in no way be disregarded. He had stood against his chieftain's forces at the very moment of their great endeavour, and shouted words of basest treachery. Lies, poisonous lies. He must be brought to justice and made to see the error of his ways. Eivind was an oathbreaker, and he must pay the price. And because no man in his right mind questioned Somerled when he had that particular expression on his face and used that particular tone of voice, they took their weapons and went out again, one party to Angus's lands in the west, one north toward Holy Island, and the last southward in the direction of Hafnarfjarðar. Somerled watched them go, and then he went back into the hall and took out the kidskin bag that held Margaret's fine set of game pieces, her farewell gift from the Jarl. He hummed to himself a little as he set them up, pale ivory, banded silver, polished board adorned with fair inlay of beasts and twining leaves. A pity there was no worthy opponent here. He must fetch Margaret back. It was time. She'd have learned her lesson by now. She must see that it was unacceptable for Ulf's widow to speak out openly against the new king's policies. Margaret had surprised him with that. After all, she had given herself to him, and that surely implied a certain level of loyalty. The experience itself had been less than a stunning success. Where was the enjoyment when a woman had no fight in her? Unfortunately, her outspoken comments had continued, beginning to awaken doubts in his household. It had become necessary to remove Margaret from court. Still, in due course, she would make a satisfactory wife. One could seek one's physical release outside the marital bed, after all. And Margaret was still the only one who could match him at games. Yes, he would recall her soon. He recognized with surprise that he missed her. Her cleverness, her ready wit, her elegance still pleased him as they had from the first. He'd just have to make it completely clear what might happen if she didn't keep her mouth shut. Meanwhile, lacking a suitable adversary, he must pit his skills against himself. His fingers reached with confidence to grasp the carven head of the small white king. Smoothly, he made his move. Chapter 10. The little boat had carried her safely to the shingly beach near Rona's cottage, but she could not leave it on the shore. That would be as good as leaving directions for finding her. Nessa scrambled over the side into hip-deep water. She scarcely felt the cold. There seemed nothing left but the weight of her grief, like a hard stone lodged where once her heart had been. She hauled the boat's hull, ripping her knife through the tarred skins that stretched across its light frame of wassails. Kinhart would have been outraged. From this small craft he had drawn in many a harvest of fine cod and sweet mackerel. He had made the curra himself over the nights of a long, dark winter, and its neat form, already slipping down beneath the sea as Nessa waded ashore, bore his love for the ocean and its bounty in every tightly fashioned seam, in every finely curved rib. Kinnart could not see his boat destroyed. Kinnart was dead. They were all dead, all but Nessa. Her uncle had held her to a promise, and she had lived. She wished she had not promised. She wished they had planned better, or not so well. They had not been unprepared for attack. If it came, Nessa was to take a small bundle and run straight to the hidden cove, below the whaleback's southern flank. If things went badly for them, she would take the boat and make her escape. Angus had refused to listen to her protests. He had put it quite bluntly. If anyone were to survive, it must be Nessa. She knew why. So he made her swear, and when the worst came to pass, she had kept her promise. There had been other parts to the plan, men designated to defend the causeway, to guard the hall, to protect the women. Women to watch over children, hide treasures, herd away stock. None of them had trusted Somerled's talk of sending messengers and waiting for answers. But to choose today, the very dawn after her mother's passing, to attack in time of deepest mourning, this betrayal had caught them quite unaware. Nessa had woken abruptly, heart pounding, not knowing what had startled her. All seemed quiet outside, yet it was as if someone had screamed her name, as if some power outside her body compelled her to run to a place of hiding now, quick, before it was too late. Yet nothing stirred. She could hear gulls passing, crying, and the soft song of the sea. She rose, thrust feet into boots, grabbed a cloak, woke the other women in the hut. She ran toward the hall, where the men still lay sleeping on the benches, worn out by the long night's solemn ceremony, senses dulled by exhaustion and strong ale. "Uncle!" she cried. "Kinnart, wake up!" For now, as she ran, she looked toward the mainland in the wakening light, and what she saw turned her chill with terror. Armed men were swarming on the point, more men than she'd ever seen gathering in one place before. And now there were cries. She heard them, and one warrior was standing there on the causeway, a tall, broad man with a beautiful helm fringed by a curtain of fine metal rings, and a big axe in his hand. And he was facing his own comrades, yelling, brandishing the weapon before him. He was trying to stop them. Around her, Angus's men began to emerge bleary-eyed from their beds, slow to wake fully, slow to grasp what lay before them. She watched a moment longer, saw Eivind kick and duck and turn amidst his attackers, saw him felled with a single massive blow. No man could survive such a blow. She felt it like a great wound to her heart. Now Somalid's warriors began to stream across the causeway, swift paced for all the forest of spears they bore, the axes, the hammers, the flashing swords. Somewhere beneath that pounding stampede of booted feet lay Eivind's body. She heard herself make a strangled sound, half sob, half scream, and then her uncle was there before her, buckling his sword belt, grey-faced, with a look in his eyes she had never seen before.
"Farewell, Mercer," Angus said. "Go now, quickly. You must not be seen. Our hope rests in you. The future is in your keeping. Go now."
From his finger he drew the heavy silver ring ornamented with the symbol of twin shields and placed it in her hand. This was no royal token, but his own personal ring of lineage. It should have gone to his son. Nessa was wordless, knowing it was the last time she would ever see him, the last time for them all. So quick, so sudden, it snatched the breath from the lips and clutched at the very core of the heart. Down beyond the hall, Kinnart was running, spear in hand, desperate to be there when the first of the invaders tried to step onto the whaleback. His young face was radiant with courage. Nessa stood motionless, her whole body aching with grief.
"Go now,"
Angus said again, and bent to kiss her on the brow. She reached up and gave her uncle a fierce hug, and then, blinking back blinding tears, she ran. This was a promise that must be kept. The dog followed her. She hoped she would remain silent, for she could not row away until the tide came up again. Nessa had no need to see, to know her people's terror in those last moments, and their courage. She sat with eyes tight shut, and somewhere deep inside her, as she heard the screams, the clash of weapons, the roar of fire, was the small image of a lone warrior making a terrible, heroic stand, one man against 50. A vision of Eivind fighting and falling, just as an ancient voice had told her he would. As the sounds of slaughter came to her ears, as her home was laid waste not 100 paces from where she hid, shivering in this stark crevice above the tide-bared rock shelves, she bore within her the knowledge that she had sent her warrior before her to die in vain. "How brave are you, Nessa? Do you have the courage to lose all that you have and still go on?" After a while, not so very long, it grew quiet again. For a little there still came sounds of men's voices, not shouting now, but speaking more levelly, as if establishing order and issuing commands. She was glad she could not hear what they said. The dog, Guard was his name now, sat close by her, his dark eyes anxious. From time to time he licked her hand, and she laid her fingers on his head, drawing some slight comfort from his warmth. She had bid Guard be silent, and he was obedient, though the sounds from above made him lower his head and flatten his ears, trembling. Nessa had learned long ago to read the subtleties of the tide. It was turning now. The voices were gone, the crackling had died down. A pall of smoke turned the morning light to sickly yellow. The water washed in gently over the rocks below her. It would not be easy to launch the curragh on her own, light as it was. In a little while she would leave here, Her uncle had said she must go as soon as she might.
"Don't look back, Nessa," Angus had said. "If we are attacked, we will fight to the end, as befits true warriors of the folk. But the odds are not in our favor here. If we fight and fail, turn away and leave this place. Find Brother Tighe, seek safe refuge on the outer islands, then passage to the land of the cat. Our kinsmen there will shelter you. You must not look back."
He had forgotten, maybe, that she was a priestess. Whatever lay unseen above her on the fair, sloping grassland of the Whaleback, she could not leave without ensuring certain things were done, certain words spoken. So, when it seemed to her all was quiet above, and the tide was rising apace, so that Somerled's men had surely passed back across to the mainland to celebrate their great victory, Nessa crept out of her hiding place. She approached the settlement cautiously. There might be guards, set here by Somerled to watch over the field of his triumph, lest there be one enemy they had missed, one youth unslaughtered, one old wife cowering in the blackened ruins. But there was nobody there. Nobody but the dead. She walked down across the trampled sward. This was the stuff of dark dreams. It was a sight to wring the stoutest heart, to pale the rosiest cheek. She was prepared to see death. She had stiffened her will for that. But these pitiful corpses, not even afforded the dignity of resting whole on their home soil. These bodies cruelly mutilated, so that not one of the men lay as he had died. This was a scene of deep unrest, a heart wound never to be healed. This place would never be a safe haven again. A blight of wrongness lay over it. The drifting smoke from the ruined hall was heavy with the memory of shame. Nessa did not weep. Her eyes were dry, her breathing calm. She felt only the cold, hard thing in her chest, a shriveled kernel of grief, a tight knot of suffering and loss. There was no sign of activity over on the point now. No sentries watched her. Only the dead eyes of her kinsmen looked on across the swirl of the incoming tide. Each blanched face gazing westward atop its savage spike, as their priestess knelt by each headless corpse, crossed each warrior's limp hands on his chest, and spoke the ritual words of farewell. "Rest, brave spirit. May the earth hold you gently in her hand. Great Mother, receive your warrior, Ferach. Your warrior, Brood. Your dear warrior, Kinnart." She knew them like brothers, one by his long, ringed fingers, one by the way he bit his nails down to the quick, one by the many freckles the sun drew on his fair skin. Down by the hall there were three women dead. They lay huddled in a pitiful heap, speared through chest and stomach and throat, still clutching one another close in their terror. All were older women who had served faithfully in Angus's household. One had nursed Nessa's mother. There were no young wives among the dead, no girls, no children. The plan had been for these to shelter in the outer hut, where stock were housed in rough weather. Two of the bigger boys, who were to guard them, lay in their blood there by the wall. "Mother, receive your fine sons, Gartnet and Roost, who never came to manhood, yet who died as men. Mother, receive your daughters who have served you loyally. They cannot be laid in earth, but see, I prepare them as well as I can, and tonight I will keep vigil and say full prayers for their passing. Take them to their rest, and forgive the stain of heedless killing that has darkened this fair place. Receive your son, Erip. Receive your son, Conal. Receive your son." She could not enter the hall, for the smouldering rubble was still full of heat. But she could see at a glance that if anything remained, it was no more than bones and ash. Nessa bowed her head. "Mother of us all, here perish the last good king of the folk in the Light Isles. Receive your son, Angus." Gard was keeping very close by her side, tail between his legs, body shivering with unease. From time to time he gave a little whine, and she bade him be silent, but kindly, for his deep unquiet mirrored what was in her own heart. Here was the cairn where her two sisters slept their long sleep. Her mother would never rest now beside these two lost daughters, for her shrouded body had not yet been laid in earth before the fire had ripped through the hall, taking dead sister and living brother together in its frenzy. When all was lost, a king must die honorably in his hall. That was a true sign of strength, and Angus was one of the strongest men she'd ever known. There was yet one thing to be done before she might leave this place of shadow. Nessa walked up the slow rise of the whaleback, and Gard followed her. The sheep ambled away, dropped their heads to graze again. Gard kept perfect pace as she came up the hill to a place from which the kinstone might be seen on the western clifftop, standing proud and strong between land and sea. There she would promise her uncle loyalty and truth. There she would swear by the stone to be worthy of the trust he had placed in her. She climbed higher, gazing westward. She blinked and looked again. The kinstone was gone. How could that be? Her eyes must be deceiving her. It had marked this ancient domain since a time of story, since the first man and woman of the folk settled on the whaleback. It could not be gone. The ancestors would not allow such sacrilege. Gard, Nessa whispered as a terrible cold began to creep through her. I don't think I can go on. Gard? But Gard went forward, and she followed. There was no choice. What carried her was fiercer than pride, darker than fury, more powerful than love. It was something old and deep, something that had no name. The kinstone was broken, shattered. It lay in pieces on the sword. The crescent split apart, the carven king sundered from his sons, who gazed blindly up into the empty sky. Here was the eagle, its flight cut short. Here the sea beast, fractured and crumbling. Somerled had not been content with his slaughter of the folk, it seemed, but must obliterate the very core of their identity. Nessa knelt by the broken pieces, reaching to touch the ancient king's curling hair with her fingers. Such blind hatred was surely born of fear. There could be no other reason for it. And Somerled was right to fear. What spoke in her blood now was powerful and dangerous. It was the same pulse that beat in every fold of this land, that sounded in every surge of waves on the shore, that rang in the heart of the standing stones and cried in the wind from the west. The islands live, the islands endure, the islands do not forget. Nessa could not gather up the broken pieces of the kinstone. They were too heavy. This work of healing must come later. She took up a tiny fragment, perhaps part of the sea beast's strange tangle of limbs and tail, perhaps not, and put it in the little pouch that held her moon charms. She found she could not chant the solemn vow she had intended. Somewhere inside her there was an anguished wailing, a wild lament that refused to be set free. The cold calm that had come over her as she settled the lost men of the folk for their long sleep had banished tears and muted her voice. That mattered little. The ancestors hear even a whisper, and an oath can be stone-sworn even when the sacred stone itself is shattered, for the truth can never be destroyed. Nessa looked to the east, down over the ruins of the settlement, and knelt to lay her hand on the head of the brave, carven king. Receive our poor broken ones, gentle earth. Cradle their spirits sweetly. Give them rest. She stood, turning to face the west, and the sun laid her shadow long and straight across the earth to touch the farthest margin of the isles. Great ocean, bear their song of courage west and east and north and south, to all the corners of the world. Let it not be forgotten what the folk were. Then she took the boat and rowed away southward to the shore near the women's place. The sun was high, but veiled by heavy cloud now. She had tarried long in that place of death, too long maybe. Nowhere was safe. It was a time for flight and concealment. Somerled understood what Nessa was. He knew what she stood for. She must move quickly and stay ahead of him. There was a task to be completed, and she must find the strength to do it, and do it alone. Once it was accomplished, it would be the time to step forward and confront him, though the thought of that filled her with dread. She had clung to hopes of Rona, but when she stumbled into the grassy hollow of the women's place, she found the cottage burned to the ground, and her old friend gone. It was clear men had been here. The earth still bore the traces of their boots. She did not see how the wise woman could have survived such an attack. Even then, Nessa could not weep. This sorrow was beyond that. It was a thing of bone and shadow, dark and deep. It had laid its hand heavily over these fair isles, so heavily it seemed beyond the strength of any priestess to lift it, be she skilled in law and steeped in wisdom, be she brave as a hero of the old tales. She would not give in to weakness. She would not lie here in the dim quiet of the tower in the earth, huddled under an old cloak that had once sheltered a damaged warrior. She would not release the tears that built and built inside her. Her little bag had been carefully packed, ready for just such a flight as this. Angus had known, as she had, how slender their hope of survival would be once Somerled had his grip on the land. She could make fire, she could feed herself for a day or two. She had a tiny lamp and oil in a cork jar. She could cast the bones in augury. She could burn herbs and sing prayers for the dead. She could perform the duties that had been set out for her since the day long ago when she had ventured a little too far into the dunes and first met the wise woman. Nessa did not sleep that night. Guard curled up on the cloak, alert enough to warn of intruders, yet not his old self. Perhaps he had hoped to find his mate here, or the man he had helped watch over. For there was something in the droop of his tail and the sadness of his eyes that touched her deeply. He did not go to hunt. He ate a scrap of hard bread from Nessa's small store, and settled by the entry to watch. She sat between lamps in the bottom chamber, and told the tale of the dead. So many names, so many farewells. She sang the story of the folk in the islands, generation by generation. How they had worked the land and fished the seas, how they had borne bold sons and brave daughters, how their kings had ruled justly, how their wise women had brought them the lore of earth and sky, had woven the rituals of fire and water, bone and moonlight. She told of her mother, her sisters, King Angus and his son Kinnart, a fine fisherman, a valiant fighter. The darkness gathered around her in the small, round space. Shadows were close. Above her on their shelf, seven small skulls watched with somber attention. "I have lost two more this day," whispered Nessa into the silence of the underground chamber. "My friend and mentor all these years, Rona, priestess of the mysteries. Mother and teacher she was to me, a wise woman indeed. It seems to me she met an unkind end, yet I know she faced it tranquilly, with courage. For if one ever were ready to move on, it was she. And I have lost another, my faithful warrior, slain in a valiant fight for truth. But for me, Eivind would still live, and could still return across the sea to his own people. I sent him forth to do my work. I sent him to his death." Her voice wobbled. This was no good. She would be strong. She must be strong. "I don't understand why I had to do that. Why your words told me he must fall in one last battle. That seems nothing but waste, since all his efforts could not stop the slaughter of our people. And to die just when he was starting to see his way forward. Did you seek to teach me that a priestess cannot entertain such feelings as I did for him? It was a harsh lesson, and I bear it in my heart, along with all the others I have learned today. I did not know how dear this man was to me until I saw him fall." She would not weep, not over this, not when so many losses must be endured. And yet, this seemed the cruelest, as she sat here alone. The knowledge that she would never again sit by him as she had that night, sharing the warmth of a single blanket, speaking as if to another part of herself, so close attuned were they to each other, To know that would never come again seemed unendurable.
"It is hard to be faithful at such a time," she whispered fiercely. "Very hard. Have you taken him from me for this reason alone, that if he had lived, perhaps I could not have remained your priestess? Have you robbed him of his future solely so that I can remain your conduit? It is very hard. So hard, I don't know if I have the strength to go on."
There was no reply. The ancestors had no answers to her questions. So, when the long farewells were ended, Nessa sat in silent meditation, for one could not command this voice if it would not come. Upright she sat, cross-legged, straight-backed, eyes open but unseeing, and made her mind still, empty, ready for what might come to her before another dawn sent its first fingers of light into the upper chamber. For a long time there was nothing. Perhaps even the ancient powers were silenced on a night of such loss. Perhaps it was beyond even them to find a meaning in such sorrow and waste. On some level, Nessa understood that the night was well past, that light would come soon. Her ears registered the little sounds of the dog shifting about in the upper chamber, snuffling, sighing, settling again to rest and watch. And at last came a fragment of thought. "Bone and ash, bone and ash, in bone and ash shall you find truth. How strong are you, Nessa?"
"Strong enough," came her answer. "I must be."
"Are you sure of that?"
"How can I not be sure? There is nobody else to do what must be done."
"You are not quite alone, daughter. Summon your strength. Find your path now. Time runs short for the folk. In bone and ash, find the true way." Morning came. As the light filtered into the chamber above her, Nessa withdrew from her trance, slowly this time, careful of her weary body and shattered spirit, until she could move fingers and toes, stretch her back, rise at last to make her way up the crumbling steps, to be greeted ecstatically by a licking, whining guard. She went out into the day. The air was warmer. The sky was a sweet, mild blue, the color of her warrior's eyes. But she would not think of that. She would not think of him. She must make a plan and go from here. If Sommel had suspected she still lived, surely this was the first place he would look for her. She shared a crust with the dog. "Let me tell you a story, guard. It's an old one, about two sisters, a king's daughters they were. They both loved the same man, but they couldn't both have him. He wanted the younger one. Her name was Dervla. One day, the elder sister pushed the younger into the river, and Dervla drowned. She floated a long way downstream in her white gown, until she came to a place where a mill wheel turned in the water. The miller thought it was a beautiful bird he saw swimming there, and then he looked closer at the lovely dead maiden and drew her into the bank. Poor girl, he thought, so sweet and so sad. I wonder what her tale was. And because he had a fancy to do it, he turned her body into a little harp, white bones for the frame of it, golden hair, the shimmering strings. There was no need to touch fingers to this delicate instrument, for the instant he set the last peg in place, the harp began to sing all by itself. And such was its song, the miller knew it for a thing of wonder and enchantment, and he bore it forth to the king's hall. A little abashed, for many grand folk sat there, the king's elder daughter and her new husband among them, the miller set his harp on the board before the king and took a step back. Then the harp began to play. Guard, oh, such a tune it played! "Oh, my father, hearken here, hearken to me, mother dear. By you my false sister stands, who drowned me with her own two hands. For the love of Conall's sweet, Dervla swam in river deep. I, your daughter, now come home, voice of truth in harp of bone." Gard looked up at Nessa. He licked her hand. "Everyone knows that story," Nessa said. or another like it. A bone harp always speaks truth. It draws its voice from the deep well of earth, from the very core of being. I think that's what it means, ash and bone. Somala did not listen to Evie. Nobody did. That much was plain. With no evidence, no witnesses, he had nothing but his axe and his courage. That wasn't enough. And so he died. Guard whined and laid his muzzle on her knee. Nessa stroked his head. "And so, you see," she whispered. "You see what we must do. You understand where we must go." A deep shudder ran through her. "I cannot do as my uncle bade me. I cannot run away, seek shelter, go into hiding. There is no point in that. I will not rally the last of my people, only to see someone had cut them down once more, to see him make a show of their remains in some perverted parade of conquest. That must not be allowed to happen. Somerled must be stopped. Now that Eivind is gone, the one man who might have made him listen, this quest has fallen to me, to summon the voice that cannot be denied, the only true witness to that evil man's deeds. I must make it known to his own folk just what Somerled is, and where he will lead them if he is not curbed. Will you go with me, guard? We must cross Somerled's land, go right to the heart of his realm unseen, and quickly, for there are women and children of the folk held prisoner in his settlement, I think, and we must do this in time to save them. Will you go?" Guard's eyes were steadfast, as only a good dog's can be. He wagged his long tail. "Right then," said Nessa, trying not to think too hard of the details, now that she knew what must be done. "I suppose we'll need a shovel and a sack or bag, and a sharp knife. I have that already. We best look over in the rubble there and see if anything escaped the fire." She moved across the empty land like a shadow, and Guard moved by her, her last loyal companion. Slipping silently from rock to bank, from standing stone to desolate barn, she made her way southeastward as the sun edged across the pale spring sky. There were early lambs in the fields, frisking and playing in their pristine white, as if there were no such thing as sorrow. She rested in the shade of a tall stone close by the lake, recognizing that its huge form had wandered somewhat since she last came this way, in a long-ago summer in a faraway world. It was well known that the stones moved, though nobody ever saw them do it. Seeking water, seeking warmth, seeking wisdom. Who could say what was in their ancient hearts, save the earth itself? This one had shifted closer to the lake, and now it sheltered Nessa's rest. She felt its warmth at her back, saw without needing to look the complex pattern of lichen that crusted its rough surface. Gold, red, grey, yellow-green. A whole small world of subtle, mysterious growth. She leaned back against the monolith, eyes closed, and knew in an instant that there was one image she could not put aside, one loss that stayed starkly foremost in her thoughts. Gold, red, the sun glinted on the waterfall fringe of his helm. Silver, gold. The light caught the fire in his axe and flashed it like a beacon. He fell. Boots trampled his limp body. Gold, red, his blood-soaked hair curled gently around his solemn, pale features. Blue met blue, his empty eyes gazing up on empty sky, seeking answers where there were none. She had sent him before her to die. She had sacrificed him for nothing. She had squandered what she had not known was precious. This was a small loss beside the slaughter of the folk, a little thing beside the death of their king. The priestess understood that. But the woman felt it like a heart wound. She knew in this hurt her own frailty, her own longing, her own mortality. He was hers, and she had killed him. "Come," Nessa said to Guard, and he rose obediently from where he lay panting on the grass by the ancient stone. "Time's passing. We must find our way there before dusk." She shouldered the bag, picked up the shovel, moved forward. The dog stepped by her lightly. He disregarded grazing sheep and hovering meadow birds and tantalizing rustlings in the bushes. The two of them went together with a single path and a single purpose. They had come a long way, and now there were people about, Somerled's people, soldiers, sentries, and Nessa knew she could not go where she must without passing them. Down the hill, below her, she could see the settlement Ulf had built in those first days of bright hope and purpose. There were several buildings, long and low, made of neat-laid stones and heather thatch over a frame of pale timbers, gifts from the sea. Men and women were walking about there, and a child ran, chasing a ball. A dog barked and guard tensed, hair rising, teeth bared. Nessa quieted him with a look, a gesture. Standing still by an outhouse wall, she gazed down the hill, seeking clues. Were any of her people captive there? The child she had seen was stocky, fair-haired, pink-cheeked. One of theirs. Where were the young women of the folk, the infants, the grandmothers? Perhaps it was already too late for them. Now there were guards coming through the gateway from the settlement, a group of them clad in leather-belted tunics and short woolen cloaks, with cap-like iron helms on their heads and short swords by their sides. They were walking straight up the track toward her. Nessa shrank back into the shadow by the old building, her heart sounding a fast music of alarm. Guard growled. She moved her hand, hushing him. The men came closer. She could hear them talking. She could hear them laughing about what they had done at the whaleback, about how easy it had been. Panic gave way to fury. Something in her was desperate to step out in the open and confront them, to scream her outrage, to awaken some semblance of shame in their complacent eyes. She stood still as if she were herself part of this stone wall, as if she could melt invisibly into its cracked surface, become one with the mosses and fine-leaved creepers that had made their home here. Guard was struggling to hold back his instinctive fanfare of challenge. Nessa kept her hand on the dog's neck, made her touch gentle and reassuring for all her own tumult of feelings. The men passed by, not 5 paces from them, seeing nothing. Their voices rose and fell, joking, jubilant, unthinking. They walked up on the hill and were lost from sight. "Come," Nessa whispered, and the two of them moved on again. Lone tree to solitary stone, small hollow to crumbling sheep pen, broken wall to clump of tattered grasses. They passed to the south of the settlement, and before the sun went down they reached a gentle hill amidst meadowland, a place of immense quiet, whose stillness was broken only by the peep and trill of inland birds, the mellow call of ewe and lamb, the soft rustle of a spring wind. Atop the hillock, a cairn had been raised. Grasses were already creeping over its surface, where earth had been laid on the stones that formed its structure. Small flowers showed here and there, yellow, purple, white, a delicate quilt to shelter a good man's slumber. There was a long view to the west. From this resting place, the dreamer of dreams could see as far as the world's end. Nessa had heard it said Ulf's wife had chosen this spot. If that were so, it seemed Margaret had understood her husband well. Nessa waited until it was quite dark, forcing down a cup of water, a crust of dry bread. When rabbits came out to forage in the dusk, Guard disappeared for a little and came back licking his lips. Both of them would need their strength, Guard to stay alert and keep watch for her, Nessa to dig. Over the years of Rona's tutelage, growing from child to young woman, she had learned many rituals. There were high ceremonies for the year's great turning times, the stepping forward into light or darkness. There were those that acknowledged a man's or woman's journey in the world, birth, hand-fasting, death. There were observances to honor the powers that sustained life, the elements, the ancestors, the deep, eternal beings. There were prayers for the hunt, prayers for the fishing boats, prayers for harvest. And there were the most secret, the most enclosed and guarded rites, such as the calling of an ancient voice, the summoning of one who might be woken only in times of direst need. Bone Mother, deep as the core of hard stone that held the earth's heart, old as the world itself and older, dark as the shadows of a prophetic dream, she was the one who had spoken. It was she who had sent Nessa here to this place of death alone. But Rona had taught no ritual for what must be done now. Nessa must pluck the words from moon and darkness, from mounded earth and the ash of memory. From her torn heart, and the knowledge that truth is the sharpest knife of all. With her small voice in the darkness, with her faltering steps on the sword, she must speak the words and pace the circle to make this an act of power. With the strength of her own hands, she must wrench bone from earth and make a new voice, sound a new song that could not be disregarded. It was dark and cold, and she was weary and heartsick beyond belief. She was the priestess of the folk, the last of the royal line in the Light Isles. She would be strong. Nessa loosed her hair from its binding to flow across her shoulders and down her back. From her little bag, she took the tiny pot that held her ceremonial clay, blue as sea shadows. She sprinkled the powdery stuff into her cupped hand, dampening it with moisture from the grass, and made the spiral in her brow, the spirit tracks of owl and osser on her cheeks. She made the bone lines on her hands. No need for clear water or shining metal. This was a practice perfected through long seasons of discipline. The eye of the spirit needs no reflection. The hand of the priestess writes truth, even in darkness. Her ritual knife was of bronze, its handle finely carved bone patterned with animals of many kinds, her own signs of otter and owl, with dog, hare, and sea serpent. This had been Rona's gift at the time of her student's first bleeding, when she had become a woman. A reminder, perhaps, of where her true path must lie. Now the knife's point traced the circle Widdershins, for this was a ritual of darkness. Under a waxing moon, Nessa acknowledged the spirits of the courses and stood a while in silent meditation, knowing this night to be a turning point, not just for herself, but for the islands and all who dwelt there. One way hatred, blood and sacrifice, the other struggle, healing, hope. "The circle holds," Nessa whispered, "until my work is done here. Mother, watch over this task of darkness. Know that I do not come to desecrate, to lay waste to what should be left sleeping, but to seek the aid of this man named Ulf, ultimately slain, a man who sought peace and light for these islands, but who brought only sickness, slaughter and chaos. He must lend his voice now in the only way he can, and so set all here on right paths. What I take this night, I take with reverent hands, knowing and accepting the power of the Dark One who gathers us all to her in the end. That which I bear forth, I will return with solemn ceremony when my purpose is achieved. This I swear as your priestess. There has been enough loss in this place, enough sorrow. Let there be no more." The moon shone silver-white, cool, impartial. Stars grew brighter, a high arc of jewels on a blanket dark as a seal's eye, dark as winter sea wrack, dark as deep cave shadows. Nessa fetched a shovel. The burial mound was sealed tight. There was no easy entrance way. It came to her, as the night wore on and she felt the sweat drenching her body, and the pain creeping to lodge itself up and down her back and along her laboring arms, that an old tale was one thing, reality quite another. Old tales did not dwell on the practicalities of a task such as this, the back-breaking toil, the unbelievably slow progress, the growing fear as time passed and she had moved so little soil, shifted so few great slabs of flagstone. She started at the top, hoping this cairn was constructed in the old manner, its stones layered to form a gradual inward curve all the way up. She hoped they had not filled it in, blanketing the dead man in earth. If they had left space, she would reach him more easily. There must be enough time before morning. There had to be. It was very quiet. Once or twice, Gard growled softly as some small creature rustled by in the grass on a nocturnal errand. Once or twice an owl hooted overhead, passing by on the hunt. Nessa could hear the gasp of her own breathing. She could smell her own fear. One stone, another. She would not throw them down. That was to offend the earth, to disturb the sanctity of the place still further. They must be set aside each in its turn, ready to be laid back in place when the task was over. But they were heavy, each heavier than the last, monumental slabs that seemed weighed down by an ancient grief. Tears spilled down her cheeks now. She labored on, letting them flow. By all the powers, she was weary. How sweet it would be to lie down and feel her warrior's arm around her warm and strong, and his breath against her hair. Right now, she did not want to be a priestess. She rested a moment, crouching as still as if she were herself another stone, an insignificant mark in this vast, quiet place under the star-pierced sky. It was so late. What if she could not achieve the task by dawn? What if she was still here, the cairn uncovered, her hands dark with soil, her tools by her in plain view? What then? She could not leave this half-completed and seek a place of safety, for Somalid's men would pass by and see what she had done. Such an act of sacrilege would ensure she was hunted down. Besides, tonight's work was only the first part of the task. She stirred. She set hands on stone again, tugging to free another slab, scraping at the soil, which had settled over and between the layers to anchor them even more steadfastly to the earth. She strained, screwing up her eyes. Please. Please. This one did not want to move. It fought against the weakening grip of her hands. Please, help me. Guard growled again, an eldritch sound that spoke both challenge and terror. Nessa opened her eyes. There were lights. Many lights across the fields around them, coming closer, moving in. Her heart lurched. Somalid's men. It was finished then. But there was no sound save a kind of whispering, like a language almost past the edges of human hearing. And the lights were surely not those of torches, for they shone eerie blue, beacons of a kind found in the tales of wrinkled grandmothers, in the songs of ancient shepherds. Bobbing, weaving, they made their progress toward the cairn, where Nessa sat staring, knowing the circle kept her safe, knowing the signs marked on her face protected her, but trembling all the same. Guard had moved in close to the mound's base. He was silent now, standing over the bag that held Nessa's small store of belongings. The moon caught the wild look in his eyes, the half-bared teeth. But he stood steady, true to the name she had given him. They came through the circle she had cast, making a ring of their own around the burial mound. Still, she could see little of them beyond those wavering blue lights. Yet here and there she half-guessed shadow forms, dark opaque eyes, squat bodies marked with ritual scars, faces that might or might not be masked, for there was no telling if they were man or creature. There was no doubt in Nessa's mind that this was the hidden tribe of the tales. Most folk had seen the lights at night in the distance, gathered by some ancient cairn, or weaving a pattern through the great stone circle in the south. One or two people claimed to have met them, and were half-believed. Every farmer had lost stored grain, or a bright cloth from a washing line. Once, folk said, it had been a babe from the cradle, and nothing but a turnip in its place, with stones for eyes. Every farmer left out bowls of milk at full moon, and small sweet cakes at harvest time. They climbed toward her from every side. Nessa shivered. What did they want? Who had sent them? She could not hide. She would not run. Instead, she set her hands to the stone again, grimacing with effort. Sweat made her fingers slip, pain shot like fire across her shoulders. She gripped the rock anew, and now other hands set themselves by hers. Hands as gnarled and knotted as dead roots. One pair, two pairs, three, and all heaved together, and the great stone freed itself from earth with a wrenching, rasping sound like a death rattle. Foul air arose from below. Nessa recoiled, her hands over her mouth and nose. There was movement around her now, stones shifting, rising, being passed down to the ground below. Long hands scrabbling in the dirt, lights moving in total silence, save for the constant rustling whispering. The hall widened, The stench dispersed in the night air. Guard whined, looking up at her anxiously. The cairn was open. Dark forms dropped down within, blue light shone up from the interior. Hands like bleached bone reached up toward her. It was at that moment that Nessa remembered how she had called for help. It was she who had summoned them. She moved, lowering herself, until the stretching hands caught her and their owners lifted her down inside, as if she were no heavier than a single owl feather. She stood by the slab where Ulf the Farseeker lay on his bed of heather, covered by his brave red cloak, and the hidden tribe stood about her in a circle, waiting. Lifting the stones, making the way in, had required strength, and she had found it, with a little help. What she must do now required an entirely different kind of strength. Every instinct shrank from the task. Her thudding heart told her the fear she had felt before was nothing to this. She took a corner of the cloak between her fingers and peeled it back. Time, and the small creatures that dwelt within the earth, had wrought their changes here. Decay had touched this chieftain's noble form, had shrunk and crumbled his fabric, and painted him livid and grey and night dark. The skull showed stark beneath the matter that still covered it. The body was collapsing within its shroud of fine clothing, braid-edged tunic, cape of close-woven wool, broad-studded belt, fine soft boots. Ulf's weapons lay by him, a helm with gilded eyepiece, a long sword, a dagger whose hilt bore a pattern of waves and suns, as if to show the will of voyage, which had been so strong in this chieftain from the snowlands. His hair lay long and dark about head and shoulders. The band of braided cloth, which had kept it neat, still circled his skull above the empty sockets of once far-seeing eyes. The hair. That was the easy part. She would start with that. Nessa's knife moved, sliced. The soft strands fell into her hand, a whisper against her blistered palm. Other hands reached out, ash pale, and took the strange harvest from her. She stepped across to stand by the dead man's right arm. In her mind, she pictured the thing that must be made. She lifted the knife, poised it in place, began to cut. The sky was beginning to lighten by the time they were finished. The folk of the hidden tribe bore the hard-won burden forth from the chamber. They lifted Nessa out and set her back on the earth by guard. And they passed the bones between them until she had packed them all safely away in the bag she had brought. She was feeling very odd indeed, as if she were not really here, as if it was some other girl who did these fearsome things and walked by these beings of story. And the real Nessa was still at home on the whaleback, tucked up asleep by her sisters, in a time when the world was to rights and no blonde giant had come across the sea to set their booted feet on this quiet shore. But she was here. She could feel the burning ache in her back. She could see the circle of shadowy figures in the darkness and hear their whispering. Oh, she was tired. She was so tired. And this was not yet finished. "Covered up," she managed. "We cannot leave him thus. The stones, the opening." Already, behind her on the mound, there were faint sounds of activity. And yet the strange companions of her moonlit endeavor stood here close by her, the blue light which shone about them fading slowly as dawn came closer. She ventured a glance over her shoulder and blinked in amazement. The hidden tribe, it seemed, was not the only force the islands had summoned to aid their priestess this night. Now small creatures of the dark crept forth, some on two legs, some on four, some furred, some feathered, some many-limbed in jewel-bright carapace. And as Nessa stared, the cairn was mended, grain by grain, pebble by pebble, the surface growing smooth and unbroken in the grey of early light. She had not seen the big stones move, but this was a place where the impossible happened every day. Folk knew that. What about the woman who'd once been a seal? What about the turnip baby? What about the monolith with a powerful thirst for lake water? Nessa looked away. Whatever had moved that weight so quickly, she thought, She would rather not look in its eyes. Still, she could see ferns rustling upward, creepers twining and binding to cover the earth she had bared. She could see spring's soft blanket moving up again to shelter Ulf's rest, until she might return to make him